Podcast, talking all things Disney with your hosts, Aljon Go and Dave Bossert.
Welcome yet again to another episode of Skull Rock Podcast. And if it's your first time listening, thank you so much for finding us. Every week, we talk about all things Disney. We talk about pop culture, never before heard stories of some of your favorite moments from film, cinema, animation, park attractions, performances, books, music, and so much more. I am your co-host, musician, longtime Disney, Marvel, Star Wars fan, and podcaster, Aljon Go. And you can contact me, email Aljon, A-L-J-O-N, at skullrockpodcast.com.
And I'm your other co-host, Dave Bossert, artist, filmmaker, author, and welcome to the Skull Rock Podcast. If you love Disney and pop culture, please subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform, including iHeartRadio, as well as like and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You can also email me at dave@skullrockpodcast.com. Well, Aljon, here we are. It's already March. Where did January and February go?
I can't
this
believe
year
it.
Is starting to shoot by.
I'm glad it is, to be honest. I can't wait. I can't wait to get out of the winter doldrums and welcome in spring where we can hopefully everyone get their shots and everybody can start enjoying life again.
Yes, it will be the roaring 20s once everybody is vaccinated. That's for sure.
I can't believe it.
I mean, we have so much to talk to, and we have a great guest. We have Christy Maltese, who's a background artist, color stylist, art director, visual development artist. She's going to be our guest on the show today. And just coincidentally, because March is Women's History Month, so I was happy that it worked out this way, that we're having Christy as our first guest of the month.
Serendipitous, is it not?
It is. It is. Just like my life.
Well, speaking of Women's Month, we can talk about some of this news.
Skull Rock Podcast, ripped from the headlines. It's Skull Rock Podcast headline news.
8.6 million, Dave. 8.6 million for Raya and the Last Dragon, number one. I never thought I would see a day and date when 8.6 million was a success.
Well, it was not only number one, but I mean, for crying out loud, being touted as a, opening weekend. right. I honestly, to me, this is a movie that probably should have opened to $100 million weekend. Don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, you could say the same thing about Soul. We could say the same thing about so many of the other films.
Any of these films that were released during this pandemic, it's crazy. But it's really kind of an interesting thing because there's a little friction between Disney and the movie theaters.
Right. Well, movie theaters are just not going to be, it's just not going to be a good thing, you know, right now until they, you know, people get back and feeling confident about re-engaging in social activities like movie theaters, right? So the film, which ended up getting glowing reviews at CinemaScore, received $8.6 million, a very soft opening for simultaneously streaming there as a premier Disney Plus Access film. So you have to pay a little bit more for that, just like you did Mulan, or you could go see it in theaters. So there you go. You know, Tom and Jerry just a week or so ago scored 14.1 million earlier for Tom and Jerry, which is a very cute film.
Yeah, so. And I mean, it's unbelievable that would do more, you know. I mean, it's doing like $5 or $6 million more than Raya and the Last Dragon. I don't know what's going on there.
I was surprised, to be quite honest. And I don't know if it's because of the media blitz that Warner Brothers put on, where Disney, I think, may have been hedging their bets in comparison, you know. So we can say that Tom and Jerry did a great 14.1 against whatever their budget was in terms of, post Super Bowl, you know, moving into and how much the money they spent. So that would be an interesting comparison. But once again, here we go. So Raya and the Last Dragon, you made a lot, not too bad. I mean, really, you know, when you think about it. Overseas, though, they debuted at $17.6 million from being in 32 markets, you know, which is not too shabby.
And, no, not at all. But listen, you know, Disney CEO Bob Chapek came out and said that the relationship with cinema has changed forever. That was from businessinsider.com. I think he's right. I mean, look, the bottom line is that I think it's changed from the standpoint, and I've said this for many, many years, 80% of the movies that Hollywood makes, you can watch on a good home entertainment center. You know, if you have a good home entertainment setup, large flat panel, good sound system, you know, any one of these rom-com movies or, you know, smaller films, you can watch those at home on demand. And I think the cinemas are going to be reserved for the big tentpole action movies.
Yeah, I specifically built this house pre-pandemic. We moved in. By the way, this is a celebration. I've been in this home now for a year. It's been a year.
Congratulations.
Yeah, we moved in at the end of February last year. I made sure, because, you know, Kristen and I are huge movie fans, we made sure to build our downstairs with just the right amount of, you know, home theater fun and excitement, because we knew we'd be spending a lot of time here. And little did we know the pandemic would mean we are spending 100% of our time here, you know? So, I mean,
you know, look, I just have to say, I mean, you know, any one of the Marvel movies or Star Wars movie or the DC films, you know, those are films I really want to see on a big screen. I have to say, Aljon, last week I watched Greyhound, Tom Hanks's movie. He wrote the screenplay for it. And, you know, it's based on the battle for the North Atlantic during World War II. And I must say, that was a great movie. I enjoyed it, regardless of some of the critics' comments about the film. I thought it was a really well done film. I enjoyed watching it. The only thing I would say is I wish I had seen it on a big screen. That was a movie I wanted to see on a big screen. And that to me is how cinema going is going to shift. I think people are going to be much more selective on what they are going to go to a movie theater to see and pay money to see at a theater.
One of those quotes from that article, Dave, was that Bob Chapek said that viewers would no longer accept a gap between theater and on-demand releases. Do you believe that's true? Can you put the genie back in the bottle now?
You know, I think it's going to be very difficult. If they want to, they will. I mean, look, let's put it to you this way. If Disney is going to release a Marvel movie that makes $1 billion at the box office, yeah, they're going to hold it back a month or two before it goes on to Disney Plus. I think they have to. With that kind of money, you know, and the cost of some of those films, you know, when some of those films are costing $175 or $200 or even, you know, more than $200 million to make a film, they need to bring in big box office. And the only way you're going to do that is letting those films out to movie theaters and then delaying the release of that film onto the streaming platform. Mm-hmm. That's what it boils down to. Now, look, you may put the movie out, you know, the 1st of March and let it run for 4 weeks in the movie theaters to make your $1 billion and then put it onto the streaming platform. You know, that gap is going to close and it's going to be much shorter for sure. But, you know, again, there's certain movies I'm just not going to watch on a streaming platform because I'm not going to get the entertainment value that I'm looking for, that, you know, compared to going into a movie theater or an IMAX screen. You know, some of the big action films, you know, some of those Marvel films, I will only go see it on an IMAX screen because I want that full experience.
It seems like it's going that way. You know, I know that everyone's talking about the new Mission Impossible and a bunch of other great action movies. I mean, you wanted to go see James Bond, on those big screens. And I think it's going to be great. I'm hoping that we do see a lot of these films get a re-release during the time when, the movie theaters are open again. So that's just something that we're going to have to pay attention to. I believe, like you, Dave, that these films do need to be released on the big screen. And I think that people will want to go out there and see them. We'll see them again. And if the content is good, they will go out and see it. And I think that, people will, I think Disney can re-release both Avengers, last Avengers movies to the box office to bring people and make theaters happy because they want to see them. They just want to see
it. Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. But also, hey, let's face it. Everything's going to start to reopen. And what do we got going on out here in California? Disneyland versus Governor Newsom. And really what's going to wind up happening now is that the amusement parks in California are going to start to reopen at the beginning of April. So for everybody out there listening, Disneyland is going to reopen, probably at a limited capacity, but it's going to reopen, which is fantastic, along with all of the Six Flags parks, Universal Studios, San Diego Zoo, and Legoland, and all of those places are going to reopen. They're going to start to reopen in April. And I think that's just good news for the economy. It's good news for, for people to get out of their homes.
Yeah. I mean, there's evidence that says during the last week of February, 27% of Americans say they felt comfortable returning to amusement parks, which is, pretty good news, because guess what? When they open, they will be at about 25% capacity, yeah, right?
It's going to be like 25, 30% capacity, which actually will be really nice not to have to battle big crowds.
Well, speaking of that, now this is a side note. We talked on my wife's podcast, Dining at Disney, and we talked about it on the Disney List podcast that I also co-host, that the Touch of Disney event happening there in Anaheim, there at the Disneyland parks, it sold out. It sold out in minutes. Yeah. And people, this is a hard ticket event, of course, right? And you can go there and you can buy food and merch and everything. You get a parking included. And it sold out in minutes, and they're adding more days. So what does that tell you? Guess what? The parks and people are ready for them to open.
Absolutely.
They're voting with their dollars.
Yeah, and you know what? People are going to be flocking to them, and I think that's great. More and more people are getting vaccinated. I think by, May, June, pretty much anybody who wants to be vaccinated is going to be vaccinated. And all of these places are going to reopen, and they're going to slowly start to creep up capacity, and I think it's fantastic. One place that's not going to have the capacity, though, is the Disney stores in North America. They're closing 60 of them.
It's the retail story that tends to always just come back, and Disney doesn't really know what they want to do. Well, and they really now they know what they want to do. They want to close them, focus on online.
This has been the craziest story, Al John, because I have to say, Disney opened the Disney stores years ago. Then I think under Michael Eisner's reign as CEO, they ultimately sold all the stores to Children's Place, who operated them for several years. And then Children's Place sold the stores, or what was left of the stores, back to the Disney company. And then Disney invested heavily in redesigning and revamping those stores. And now here we are, they're going to be closing them because they want to focus more on retail, the e-commerce retail, and not so much on regular bricks and mortars. But I think they're missing a big opportunity opportunity here because I think that the Disney stores could be turned into some really great experiences,
I agree.
Destination kind of things where people can go and they can, you know, book cruises and, you know, book vacation club trips or buy into the vacation club. There's so much more that they can do, and they have to evolve these retail stores into destination experiences. That to me is what has to happen.
I agree. Now there are 300 Disney stores worldwide, and 60 of the North American stores are going to close to focus to online activities. I don't know how many of those stores in the United States are going to close. You look at 60 of 300 worldwide, and of those, is it all of them, Dave? Is it all of them? Because it's a very interesting, I don't know what that means.
Basically saying that they're closing 60 stores in North America. So if they have 300 stores worldwide, I mean, obviously that's 20% that they're closing, but they're targeting the stores that are in the U.S., in North America, primarily the U.S. And I have to say, you know, this is the age-old story that's been going on where retail is just crumbling. Shopping malls are, you know, going to go the way of
Dodo Bird.
Yeah, you know, I mean, they're sort of, I look, there's a town center near me, you know, a shopping mall near me that I have not stepped foot into the main portion of the mall in probably now a couple of years. You know, I've gone to some of the restaurants that are on the periphery of the mall, but I haven't actually been in the mall. And so there's a big sea change going on in retail that is going to go on for some time until they figure out how to make those shopping malls destinations for people, you know? Yeah. And that's really what it boils down to. How do you attract people there? How do you make it a destination? There's an awful lot of ways of doing it. And some of them are more successful than others. And it's going to be a slow transformation and a slow evolution. And there's going to be a lot of shopping malls that are going to drop by the wayside and be, you know, turned into something else.
That's true. Well, going back to streaming, it looks like one of our favorite shows, Dave, The Simpsons, is getting another renewal for not one, but two seasons.
I thought this was fantastic. You know, I mean, look, it's all about the writing. It's very topical. And I have to say, who doesn't love the Simpsons? I'm a huge fan. I think I've seen almost every single episode.
Amazing, Dave.
More than once.
That's amazing.
More than once.
You see, between the Simpsons, and I can't fault people for liking them, you know, Kristen and I are Family Guy fans. Because we love that edgy, you know, edginess and South Park. So it's good to see that these animated shows are continually showing that they have legs. And congratulations to the team, because once again, yeah, it is a great, great property and great, great storytelling. Speaking of great storytelling, Dave, I know that WandaVision had its series finale this past Friday.
And it crashed the system again, didn't it?
It crashed the system. And once again, you know, I have to say that congratulations for a great storytelling. I have to say that I was a big fan of what they're doing with the show. And I can't wait for more Elizabeth Olsen in the MCU. And hopefully the rest of the family and villains will come back too. And by the way, I have to say, Jimmy Woo, Randall Park is just, I think he's going to be the new Phil Coulson of the MCU, because he's just too good to...
Don't give too much away, because I still have some catching up to do on WandaVision.
Well, you've seen WandaVision thus, you know, some of the episodes, maybe you're halfway there, but, you know, Randall Park.
I'm halfway through.
It's the year of Randall Park, because not only was he great in Ant-Man, he's great in the new NBC show with The Rock, The Young Rock. Jimmy Woo is just, he is the guy. And of course, you know, Fresh Off the Boat was a great TV show too for ABC, because I mean, yeah, what up, Asian represent, you know, gotta, you know, Asian represent. And Randall Absolutely. Park is just a great. So I can't wait to see your take on WandaVision. Dave, when it's all finished for you.
I'm going to try and get through it this week, and we could talk about it next week. How's that?
Great. Let's do it. And also a big, big shout out to the MCU team, because we didn't touch base on this, but they did reveal the new Spider-Man name for the film, Spider-Man No Way Home. And it's going to tie in. It's going to tie in with WandaVision and Doctor Strange, Multiverse of Madness. So I can't wait to see how the multiverse is being served in the MCU.
Fantastic.
There you go.
Well, this is, there's so much great stuff. And I just think that there's going to be a tremendous amount of people wanting to get the heck out of their homes and go to movie theaters, go on cruises, go down to Disneyland and Disney World and the other parks out there, and really sort of, like I said, it's going to be the roaring 20s over the next couple of years with people. Yeah, it's going to be fabulous. But, hey, I think we need to get to our guest, because we have her waiting in the green room. And I think we should jump in.
Let's do it. Christy Maltese, it's Women's Month, so let's celebrate with another awesome female animator.
Skull Rock Podcast, interview time.
Oh, Al John, I am so thrilled to have our next guest, Christy Maltese, with us. She is a key background painter, a visual development artist, an art director. She's somebody I've worked with for many, many years in the business. She worked at Disney. She's worked at a bunch of different animation studios. So I want to welcome you, Christy, to the Skull Rock Podcast. How are you doing?
Dave, it's an honor to be with you. I am just fine this morning. Thank you very much. Happy to talk to you and Al John this morning.
You know, I got to tell you, Christy, all the years that I have known you, I had no idea that you worked on the Smurfs, the Flintstone Kids, and Popeye and Son. I didn't know that. What's the story behind all that?
So actually, I'm not even sure if I worked on Popeye and Sons. I'm not sure about that one.
It lists you as doing IMDb. 13 episodes.
It could be I just don't remember, or I could have done, I don't know, something on one of them that was reused in several others. I don't know. But my first job in the animation business was at Hanna-Barbera. So yes, I painted a boatload of Smurf backgrounds. The first background I ever painted, the first thing I ever painted, was a overlay. It was on the Flintstones, and Dino the dinosaur was supposed to be running away from camera over a little hill. But there wasn't anything for him to run on. The hill was there, but there wasn't a little pathway. So I had to take a cell and paint an overlay of a little pathway, which basically consisted of, you know, a couple of coats of one color of paint in a semi little arc thing. And that was it. That was the first thing I ever painted. I just felt like I was so, I was just thrilled. I was thrilled.
That is so awesome.
That is my Saturday morning right there.
A lot of Flintstones, a lot of Smurfs. We painted the Jetsons was still going on at that time. I think Johnny Quest was still, it was being aired somewhere else, not here, but they were still producing it.
So it was kind of like a boot camp for background painting, wasn't it?
Because it was Hanna-Barbera was Hanna-Barbera was a boot camp in general for the animation process. It was a fabulous place to start. And thank you, Al Gamir. Thank you, Marzette Bonar, for being out on maternity leave. And Al had to replace her with somebody. And I was at the right place at the right time.
But let me ask you this question, Christy. How did you get to that place? Like, were you painting when you were in high school? Yeah. Did you know you wanted to get into an art career?
Like most of us. Path? Yeah. Yes, like almost all of us that I have met in the animation business, I was always painting, drawing something. I was, you know, there were two or three kids in every class who everybody knew were the artists. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was one of those. And I do remember my mother not really freaking out, but I do remember her talking about my crayoning on the hardwood floor. So yeah, my art career went way, way, way back. But yeah, I always wanted to do, my goal back then in high school was that I wanted to illustrate children's books. And I went to Art Center, went through their illustration program, didn't hear one word about animation the whole time I was there. The head of our department was, well, in the first place, animation had basically, that was at a time, it was in the early 80s, and that was at a time when animation was really struggling, you know, really on hard times, had fallen on hard times, and Disney was, you know, on the verge of breaking up and all that. And so I didn't even think about animation at all. It didn't even, was not on the radar. And a friend of mine that I went to Art Center with, Steve Lubin, after we graduated, somehow he found a job at Ruby Spears, and he was in the animation department. He was doing cleanup or something. And I was griping to him one day about how I was having such a hard time with a freelance illustration career. I was really having a hard time with it because I'm not really much of a, at that time there was, the only way to get a job was to call people and spend money on gasoline and drop off your portfolio at some company and come back and pick it up a week. You know, I mean, it was a mess. It was just a mess.
Pre-computer days. You didn't have a website that you could just email and say, hey, go to my website and see my artwork. Yeah.
Couldn't do that. Yeah, it was all, I mean, you got on your burrow and, you know, made the 3-day trip to Los Angeles from San Diego. Anyway, I was talking to Steve one day and he said, you know, you got to talk to this guy. His name is Eric Simonis and he's a really nice guy and he's our backgrounds guy. And, you know, you might want to think about that. And it was just sort of an offhand thing. And just because there was nothing else to do, because I had nothing to lose, I called this guy, Eric. And he said, well, come on up and show me your portfolio and, you know, we'll talk. And I'm telling you, he was the most gracious man. So kind and so open. He spent his entire lunch period, you know, with me, who he had never met before. He didn't know me from Adam. Spent the entire lunchtime with me and he showed me backgrounds and he showed me layouts and he looked at my portfolio and he said, you know, this is a really nice portfolio, but it doesn't look anything like backgrounds. And he gave me, he Xeroxed some layouts and some of his painted backgrounds from those layouts. And he said, here, take these home. And if you do things that look like this, then you'll have more of a background that looks like, you know, background, or you'll have a portfolio that looks more like background paintings. And I really took his advice to heart and I went home and it took me a year, but I basically redid my whole portfolio from stem to stern. And I needed a job that I went to every day. I did not want to deal with all this hyping myself and all this running around. And all. I just wanted to go to a job and come home every day and somebody pay me for it. And this whole background thing, you know, which I had never heard of in my life before, sounded reasonable. So I redid my whole portfolio. And I, at the end of that year, I went around to all the different studios and like I said, there was a gal at H&B who had just gone out on maternity leave and they needed to replace her with somebody for 2 months. It was a 2-month job.
Wow.
And Al hired me and he was so, I'm telling you, my entry into background painting into the animation business, into background painting was one lucky strike after another. I just fell backwards into it. And it was such a good match, a really, really good match, because I'm not really a sort of a kingmaker type. You know, let me put it this way. I am definitely a team player. I like being on a team. I like being on a, a bigger project than I can handle myself, but I like being part of it. And so this was a really, really good match for me. And I loved the people that I worked with. I had great bosses. I just loved it. And
you know, the one thing I was going to mention as you were talking here is that you talked to a person at Ruby Spears and then you wound up getting hired over at Hanna-Barbera. But really, there were only like three big studios for Saturday morning cartoons in town. There was Hanna-Barbera, there was Ruby Spears, and there was Filmation.
Yes.
And there was a couple other little boutique studios that were doing commercials and things like that. And then, of course, there was Disney. Where there was, and that was the only shop really doing feature animation at the time.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of a closed ecosystem for the most part, because people that were working there had been working there for years. And there wasn't too many spots that opened up. But you were right. It was in the depths of the animation industry at that point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There had been a big strike. A lot of work had gone overseas to the Pacific Rim. And, it was kind of thin as far as studios. Nothing like it is today with
animation
studios, right? You know?
Well, so. Not only that, but the art schools, all of the art schools have huge animation department. You know, it's like an entire discipline now, animation. Whereas when I was in school, it was not even, like I say, it was not even on the radar.
Nobody well, in Los Angeles, you had your choice between Art Center or California Institute of the Arts, Cal Arts.
Yes.
Those were sort of the two places that if you ran into people in the animation industry, they either had gone to Cal Arts or they had gone to Art Center in Pasadena. Mm-hmm. And then there was always the Canadian contingent who came from Sheridan College up in Toronto.
There were some also from the East Coast. There was the Rhode Island, you know, the RISD, Rhode Island School of Design. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There were those people.
Few and far between, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah.
You know, the odd person from the School of Visual Arts in New York City or something, you know?
Yeah.
So you're painting backgrounds at Hanna-Barbera, and really, like I said earlier, that was kind of a boot camp, so to speak, that gave you street cred.
It was boot camp. I say that because it was the space, the actual space, was pretty small, and you know, layout was right down the hall. The Xerox department was, you know, just right around the corner. Everybody that I needed to talk, if I had a question on a layout, all I had to do was walk down the hallway, you know, and talk to the guy who did it. Or, I don't know, it was a way of, you kind of got thrown into the deep end and you learned the entire production process by osmosis and just by sheer necessity. I really learned the process of animation, of course, of 2D animation, which came in handy when later on when I came to Disney, because at Disney when I did come to Disney, which was a couple of years later. Disney was a different animal. It was, it's huge, huge company, and departments tended to not kind of mix a whole lot. You know, like if you had a question on a layout, you would go to your supervisor, your department supervisor, and that person would go find out. So I it was just a little bit more insular. The departments were a little more insular at Disney.
And it was a different way of doing Disney has their own animation process that was different from other studios. And and also you had the luxury of a little bit more time.
Oh, yes. 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 But that was another reason that I am so glad that I started at Hanna-Barbera or at a TV studio, because those kinds of deadlines really got you in shape for for, you know, you do a whole lot of editing in your head before you even put a stroke down on the paper.
No, without question. And I think, you know, working under those heavy duty deadlines actually instills a bit of a work ethic in you.
Right off the bat
that you know, you're constantly striving to get something done in a reasonable amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when we were working on, cause you came into Disney on The Little Mermaid.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so there was a little bit more time, to spend on painting backgrounds. I mean, just to give our listeners a just sort of a sense, how many background paintings would you have done at Hanna-Barbera in a week compared to, how many backgrounds you did when you got to Disney on The Little Mermaid?
Probably the pace was about 3 to 1, I would say.
So you do
easily.
You would
easily
do
3 to 1, 4 to 1.
How many backgrounds in 1 week would you paint at Hanna-Barbera on average?
Probably 3.
3.
At Disney, yeah. 1.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that just really shows, I think, the so the more time you have on a feature, and also the quality that's going into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because,
definitely.
Because the Saturday morning backgrounds are less detailed and broader.
Definitely.
Paintings for the most part. Whereas but when you do a background, a Disney background, you've got a lot more detail, but you're also spotlighting where the characters are going to be and things like that.
That's one thing that I really did really like too, because when you got a layout at Disney or any of the, you know, major studios, you had all the information that you needed for that scene. So the layout contained not only just the layout and, you know, for the listeners, a layout is basically a line drawing, and you trace that down on a board and paint it up. But the layout is much more than just the drawing. The layout gives you the footage of that scene. It gives you if there's a camera move on it, it will give you the start and the finish frames. And it'll also tell you how much time, for instance, how much time the camera will stay at the start before it starts moving. It gives you the characters, the placement of the characters, where they start and where they finish. Let's see what else it gives you.
And just for the listeners, I mean, it's literally a drawing of key poses of the character.
Yes.
Where they're going to be throughout the scene on that background, so that you, as the background painter, have a sense of, okay, the camera's going to be here for the bulk of the time.
Exactly.
I've got to make sure that, you know, I've got enough information on that background.
Exactly. And also it gives you the freedom, or it, I don't know, I guess, yeah, the freedom. You know where to, like, put your money. So if the character is going to be covering up the whole right side of that thing for most of it, then you're not going to spend all that time detailing out whatever, you know, books or candlesticks or whatever it is back there, a grotto. You're not going to detail that out. You're going to let that just kind of be, you could paint some of that stuff with the bottom of your shoe and be okay. But then if the camera is going to be, so if the characters is covering up part of it for most of it, then you just paint out the area that the character will not be covering up. You spend all your time on that area. And in that way, you can save time on a background. You know, you don't have to spend 2 weeks on it.
Right. And, you know, you again, that's part of the thought process in creating that background painting. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're doing an establishing shot, it's going to be a killer, detailed, beautiful mm-hmm. background. I often bring up Bambi when talking mm-hmm. about backgrounds, because mm-hmm. that's a great example of spotlighting the characters. And then letting the background kind of fuzz out, almost kind of fade out a little bit on the periphery.
Those Those Bambi backgrounds are about as close to sacred as you can get when it comes to Disney backgrounds, or when it comes to, you know, any kind of secular artwork. Those things, they were just absolutely gorgeous. And of course, you know, they had the time to experiment around, and a lot of them were painted in oils, which is never, ever, ever going to happen. That would never happen. And they were absolutely gorgeous. Yes, they were. And they also really captured Tyrus Wong's development work for that right. film. Really, yeah. really captured the real emotional feeling of those backgrounds. You know, it was really moody and just absolutely gorgeous, very sparse in a way.
Yeah. 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 I, you know, the other background film that I often point to is The Old Mill, because that really was to me a background picture. It was spearheaded by Claude Coates. It to me evokes such mood and emotion. He was, I think, one of the first what I would call a background picture, you know.
It definitely is. You know, I never thought of that before, but I think you're right, because up until then it was definitely character driven, for sure. Characters yeah. were yeah, and the backgrounds were sort of like just, oh, they're just backgrounds. You know, yeah. The Old Mill, I think that's part of the definitely part of the charm and the allure of that film, is just how gorgeous it is. It's just so it just captures you. It's
rich, you know, it's rich, yeah. it's lush, it's detailed. You know, it really does bring out it evokes an emotional response.
Definitely.
When you look at some of those scenes.
Yes, yes, it definitely does, in a way that Steamboat Willie would not do ever.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. you know. Yeah. But you moved up the ranks, I think, fairly quickly once you got to Disney, because after The Little Mermaid, you worked on Rescuers Down Under, Beauty and the Beast, mm-hmm. Aladdin, and then you became the background supervisor on Pocahontas. Mm-hmm. Talk us through some of those pictures and how you kind of moved up.
I just felt like I had been on a couple of films, and I absolutely adored my job. I loved my job so much. I could not love my job more. I had such a good time there. And like I say, you know, it was
a good group of people. I mean, there was a great group.
Great group of people. We had a great little department, and the whole crew was just fun. We were there on Flower Street at the time, which was at a time when Disney Features was still pretty small. And, you know, you could see, bump into Peter Schneider in the hallway and have a little chat. But I had been there for, you know, on several films, and I don't know what some kind of little bee got in my bonnet. And I thought, you know, I could run this zoo. Maybe I could do this. And so I decided, I knew Pocahontas was coming up. It was something, it was a project that intrigued me. And I did some development work on my own, and I showed it to Mike Gabriel, who was
one of the directors,
yeah. and Mike Jama, who was the art director, yeah. and I just kind of kept on feeding them work now and then, you know, and I was just kind of stunned when they asked me to head up the department. And I was very happy to do so. I was just thrilled. And it just kind of worked out really well. I knew everything on that film. I was up to date. I was current on every single thing that happened in every single scene. Like, I could tell you the sequence and scene number of anything in that film.
That's always the way, isn't it? You know, it's seared into your brain. When you were doing some of the early stuff that you were feeding to Mike Giamo and Mike Gabriel, were you referencing the J.C. Leyendecker and had that come into play at that point yet?
No.
I just wanted to say to the listeners that oftentimes on a film, the artist will gravitate towards a particular style or an artist that influences or inspires them for creating the look of a picture. And for Pocahontas, it ultimately boiled down to J.C. Leyendecker, who was an illustrator back in the Art Deco 1920s, 30s period, right? When did that come in?
I did not even know that Leyendecker existed. You know, in the Pocahontas world, I didn't know that they had been looking at him. I had no idea who they were looking at.
Oh.
I have no idea. I just did some stuff on my own. It was, it was just my own stuff. You know, like a little kid sitting in the middle of a river, dangling his foot in it. And what else did I? Oh, God. There are probably three or four larger-ish paintings and a couple of smaller ones. Things that I thought would look like backgrounds, you know.
For Pocahontas,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I would throw in a character here or there, just kind of really small.
Yeah.
But because I'm not a character animator. I'm not an animator. I have no, I'm not a portraitist. And I like landscapes and all that. So that was another reason why backgrounds and I were friendly to each other. I just did a couple of things on my own. And I learned later that Leyendecker was one of their resources.
And I think you're right, though, but a lot of people were like, Leyendecker, who's Leyendecker? But there's all these great artists that had specific styles from the teens and the 20s and the 30s, you know.
And you can see it. You can see it in film history. You can see it in Disney film history, who they were looking at as reference, you know, if it was Arthur Rackham or Tennyson or Tenniel or
you know, like even on the early films like Snow White and Pinocchio and Fantasia. I mean, you do have that sort of European book illustration look to it. Whereas when you get to 1950 and Cinderella, you start to get into that more graphic look that where animation was starting to go towards the UPA style and all of that. So, but I always find that fascinating because one of the things I always love about Disney films or the Disney animated features is that each one had its own style, really.
And so no matter what your source material is, it always kind of evolves into its own little style.
Correct. Yeah. You're not copying those people. You're being inspired by them and you're sort of taking inspiration to create the look that you're going for a picture. And certainly Pocahontas has a really specific look. And if you look at Pocahontas and you look at Frozen, you can see some similarities there. And again, same art director on both of those pictures.
Art director.
So
he loves his magentas.
He does, doesn't he?
He's a wonderful man. I learned more. Here's another thing. Mike Giamo, I learned more from him artistically working on Pocahontas close to 3 years, I think I was on.
Yeah,
I learned more from him than I did at Art Center, than I did at school from all of my teachers. I learned more about how to design a page and I learned more about color relationships too.
Color styling.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He's such a great teacher too, isn't he? I mean, he's just got that disposition where he can really bring people along.
He's a good communicator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He really is. So when you were working in backgrounds at Disney, I have to say, you were there for Little Mermaid, Rescuers Down Under, and Beauty and the Beast. You overlapped, I think, with Jim Coleman. So you knew Jim, yes. Didn't you? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Because Jim yes. was Jim was kind of transitioning. Jim was the background supervisor, I think, through Black Cauldron. And then after Black Cauldron, he wanted to just be a background painter. And he transitioned mm-hmm. out of the studio into his fine art.
Yes.
The fine art painting that he's known for now.
Yeah.
But there was really, I think, a really great group of artists in the background department during those years, wasn't there?
They were excellent. I think at some point, everybody at Disney has this, what am I doing here moment.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, like, any second they're going to learn that I'm a no talent hack, but there's such a support group there. It's like you really, really had to try very, very hard to fail there mm-hmm. because you had nothing but support and good people really wanting you to do your best. And it was just a very, very positive environment. Everybody knew each other. It was very family-like. Like, we were all siblings, and you'd have like little spats here and there, and then everybody would make up, and they'd be kissing, make up again. I've often thought that there would be a great book. There's a really good book in there somewhere about the background painting department, because we had the one guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was going to say there's a good book in each department.
There is. Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
We had one guy who was always practicing his golf swing. I don't know when he painted, because he was practicing his golf swing so much. And then we had another guy who always took a nap in the middle of the day under his desk.
Oh, you know something? There was a number of people that did that. Phil Niblink was an animator at the studio during those years.
That name. I don't remember.
Yeah, you know what? I think he had left by the time you got there. But Phil was known for taking a nap during lunch. And he would just crawl under his desk and he'd take mm-hmm. like a 20-30 minute nap.
And there's plenty of room under those desks.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And
big enough.
No, they were, but that was, it was true though. But I mean, there was some really, I think some amazing artists throughout the all the different disciplines, but you know, you touched on something, you mentioned something, and I think I want to dwell on it for a second. As an artist, every single artist has gone through those moments of I'm a fraud. They're going to find out soon and fire me, you know? Mm-hmm. And and I don't think I've ever met an artist who hasn't had that kind of a feeling. It's natural. It's a natural thing, but you kind of work through it, you know, and you do produce good work.
Yes. It's just a cyclical thing. I think, or I don't even know if it's cyclical. I think it happens. You kind of get into that spot and then, you know, you've got bills to pay and things like that. So you have to work. It's not like you have an option there. So you do get through it. And, you know, maybe that background wasn't all that bad after all. And I think it's just something that artists do because, you know, we're so driven by esoteric things, you know, and everything has to, it has to look good. It's not easily definable. It's not mathematics, you know, it's not that. We're trying to create something that is greater than the parts of, you know, greater than its parts, and something that's maybe a little transcendent. And so you try, you know, that's the goal. And of course, perfection is the goal. You're not going to get there, but it's the goal. You got to have a goal. And so it's, you know, when you create something that you know where all the bodies are buried, and you can point to 100 places in that background that you wish you could have changed. But you're the only one who knows that stuff.
Right. Absolutely.
You're the only one who knows that. And I think, you know, you can kind of get carried away with that. You know, this background has so many problems with it. And you can kind of get carried away with that. But I think, you know, I mean, well, there are ways of getting around that. You just work through it. And
yeah. And you know,
get
something.
Over it. You realize that everybody's going through the same thing, too. So
everybody does go through that. And I think that's something it's important to recognize and to confront, you know,
because
you know, we've all had these fabulous careers since getting into the business, and you just keep moving forward. And yes, there's always going to be that scene that you did in a movie that you see from time to time and say, I wish I had
just cringe,
whatever, I wish I had changed that, or I wish that I wasn't so rushed to get that done, you know.
Yes.
But it is what it is, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that you just improve from picture to picture to picture, or project to project.
Yeah.
What do you remember most about that period of Little Mermaid through Pocahontas? Because it really was sort of an explosion within you look to that, and it's sort of the nucleus of the renaissance of Disney animation. Mm-hmm. You know, really taking off again. And yes, you mentioned we were at Flower Street, and just again, a lot of our listeners think of Disney animation being on the storied Disney studio lot in Burbank, mm-hmm. which is where mm-hmm. I started. Mm-hmm. But by the time we got to Little Mermaid, we had already been moved off of the studio lot to Glendale, a couple miles down the road from the studio, into a one-story sort of warehouse-like building.
Mm-hmm.
That I think there might have been 150 or 170 of us in, and it was sort of like almost the demise of Disney animation. And fortunately, it wasn't. It was the rebirth of it.
Yes, strangely it was, because I don't know if you remember, or I don't even know if you effects artists had these conversations, but in the background department, you know, there was kind of some grumbling, a little bit of grumbling about the digs that we were in, you know, the conditions of this place, because it was clearly a repurposed warehouse. You know, it could have used a coat of paint, it could have used, you know, 100 things to improve it. But, and then at some point they announced plans to build this big, fabulous building on the main lot for all the executives.
Yes.
And I remember that because all the lawyers were going to go in there, you know, all these, anybody who was not an artist got this big, you know, splashy office and stuff. And we were just in shock. We were just in shock. I couldn't believe our eyes, you know, when that came out in the paper. And anyway, it wasn't long after that that we were moving into another great big building of our own.
Sure.
But, it was cramped, it was small, they really made it, I mean, they made an effort to make it more,
livable.
Livable.
Which is all relative.
Totally relative. But there were definitely, there was a whole phase that I went through on Pocahontas, where my office somehow, I don't know, there was something about the wiring in that building where my office would just blink out. I would just like lose all my lights would go out, everything would go out. I would have to go charging over to color models And there was like this little reset button behind somebody's, I don't know, pube or something. I had to push that reset button, you know, for 30 seconds, then go trundling all the way back to my office and my lights would be back on again. But if that was the kind of place that we worked at, that was the kind of conditions we were in.
Yeah.
And by the way,
I was just going to say, by the way, Christy, you were in really nice conditions because you were in the warehouse that was converted to offices. The effects department was in trailers in the WDI, the Imagineering parking lot. We were in trailers. We were envious of you guys.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Everything is relative, isn't it? And then there's also that whole topic of anybody who is not an animator, all the departments that were not animation felt like the bastard child of animation.
And you know? Absolutely. Always. Yeah. It was always the case.
Yeah.
I think, though, as soon as they moved us off the studio lot in Burbank out of the original animation building into that warehouse, it was sort of like we were out of sight, out of mind. And it allowed us to create all those great pictures because
I've often said that about Florida as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were out of sight.
Did you ever work in the Florida studio? Did you ever go down there?
Well, they helped us out on Pocahontas and also, so I did go there.
Yeah, like for a few weeks or something, right?
Yeah, I went there for a couple of weeks and just loved it. Man, that was a real magical little spot.
Once you got past the
fishbowl had been shut down by the time I got.
Okay, good.
Yeah, the fishbowl didn't last for too long.
Yeah.
And for people who are listening, the fishbowl refers to the fact that the Florida Animation Studio was actually an attraction at Walt Disney World because on one whole wall, it was glass. It was like a really, really super, super thick, probably a plexiglass or something. And people could walk by, visitors to the park could walk by and look in and see how the animation process was happening. And they could see animators animating, they could see background painters painting, they could see color models doing their thing, and they could see cleanup doing their thing. And it was really great for the visitors to be able to see that, but the artists themselves were not exactly happy with it.
Al John, you saw it, didn't you?
Oh, that was one of my favorite parts. My wife and I love that.
Yes,
you know, but I can.
It would be really great because otherwise you can't see it. You can't see that stuff happening. Cool. You have no idea.
No, I love
it. I know that the background. In the background department, I don't know about other departments, but they would always stick the trainees over by the glass wall because nobody else wanted to be there. You know, you got somebody looking over your shoulder, literally strangers looking over your shoulder all day long.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
I went over there to Florida one more time on the final film that was never produced there called My Peoples. That was their project. And I was going to head up a small department out here in California to help them out on a couple of sequences. So I went over there
My Peoples for listeners was a feature film that was really about a group of folk art characters that come to life. And it was sort of a Ozark bluegrass kind of vibe to it that Barry Cook was attached to as the director. I don't know who else was. Was there another director? Was it just Barry?
I can't remember. I can't remember. Yeah. I can't say. I do remember Barry. I don't. If there was another one, I don't remember.
Yeah, but it was in development, and it was a I think a victim of them closing the studio down. They just
decided
not to do that picture and then closed the studio.
Dolly Parton had written some beautiful songs for that film.
Yeah.
Gorgeous
yeah.
songs.
That's right. Yeah. Wow. I remember seeing a lot of visual development on that picture, and I really was looking forward to actually seeing mm-hmm. that movie, and I was mm-hmm. really sad that it never got made.
Yeah.
I thought it would have been a great film.
Yeah. I did too.
Maybe
yeah.
they'll resurrect it someday.
Maybe. You never yeah. know. You know, Little Mermaid started out in about 1942 or something.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
They finally got released in 1989.
Exactly. And also Snow Queen was developed in the 40s as well.
Yes. Yes.
Eventually became Frozen.
Yes. So, uh-huh.
you know, mm-hmm. yeah, there's always hope that some of these pictures yes, will be dug out of the archives and actually yeah. resurrected.
Yeah.
What are your fond memories of working on backgrounds? And by the way, you're still working. I mean, you've mm-hmm. worked on Enchanted. You worked on Home on the Range, Curious George, Hotel Transylvania, Cloudy with Meatballs, mm-hmm. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2. You've art directed. I mm-hmm. actually hired you to art direct on The Cat That Looked at a King for the 40th anniversary. Anniversary of yes. Mary Poppins DVD. Yes. Uh-huh. So, uh-huh. And we're working together right now on a project. We won't talk about it, but Christy and I work from time to time. Actually, Christy doesn't live very far from me. So pre-pandemic and hopefully post-pandemic, we do get together for an occasional glass of wine here and there.
You're such a tease, Dave.
I rope you into that, and it's real easy to rope you into that.
Yeah, you all you have to do is say wine, and I'm there.
I don't have to twist any arms at all. Well, yeah, remember that one time I sent you an invoice, and it said one bottle of quality red wine. That was my whole invoice.
That was her. Yeah, it was, because she did some little thing for me that took her like 10 minutes to do it. But she could do it and I couldn't. And I made good on that. We had a very good bottle. We had a very good bottle of wine, if I recall. I think it was a Stag's Leaf.
Okay.
Yeah, yes.
That's all you had to say. I'm like, wow, Dave, nice. You didn't get the bottom box this time.
Oh my gosh! But you know that's really what the industry is like. It is like one big family, because
you can
contact people and get together with them pretty easily in the area, and everybody helps one another out. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever reached out to Christy with something that I wanted to have her work on where she said, no, I don't have time or I can't do that. She's always said yes to me.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
Always make time for me, Dave.
Yeah, there you go. So I feel fortunate, because you are a tremendous talent, I have to say. And I love your painting style. I really love it. And by the way, people can see your paintings or some of your paintings on your website, right?
Mm-hmm. Is it
christymaltese.com?
Christymaltese.com. And if you just kind of type that in, make sure you don't throw an H in my name, because it won't work.
There you go. All right.
C-R-I-S-T-Y, Maltese. I don't know why my parents did that to me, but they did. I think it's great.
And Aljon's going to add that to our show notes for people, because I would encourage folks to actually check out her website, because she does have a really nice range of paintings in her gallery there.
I need to update that a little bit with some more of my more current stuff, and I'll do that.
So, you know, getting back to the background painting, I know you have done a lot of different jobs over the years, and you do a lot of visual development work now.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between doing background paintings and actually doing visual development on a project, and why you like that better?
I'm not sure I like it better. I would say I like it just as much. I would say I like it just as much, because it's very creative. I would say it's probably a little, yes, definitely more creative because, okay, so a background, like I was talking about before, has a layout. You are very restricted to what is going to be painted. You know, you have definitely, you know, it's laid out for you, literally laid out for you. So you've got a drawing and you got to stick to that. But with development, you either, you know, depending on where the project is, you can just blue sky it, or you can, you know, if you need to research something or use some source material that is more developed, then you can use that too. You know, you can, I guess what I'm saying is you can be as creative as you want, or sometimes you have to kind of stick to something that's already been designed. But with development, I would say one of the biggest differences too is that you don't have to tie everything down. You know, with a background,
it's a little looser, right?
It's looser. It's definitely looser.
You're experimenting.
The experimentation is the real fun part, because you can experiment with color relationships and moods and, you know, just placement, styles, different styles, you know, monochromatic maybe, you know, fully or full color. You can do any kind of, you know, more of a cartoony style. I would say cartoony, like, you know, big heads, big eyes and things like that. Or, you know, something a little bit more naturalistic. But it is a completely different thing. And the sizes too are much different. You know, lots of development stuff is very small. Mm-hmm. It's real small. And it's also just sort of like dashing off an idea, just getting something down there, just capturing a momentary spark. Whereas the background painting is that's a whole different thing.
And the style has already been established, and
it's been established.
You're being handed a drawing that you transfer to an illustration board, or in the case of digital painting, you're taking a scan of that into your system, and mm-hmm. you start painting digitally. But it's already been established, and we're in visual development. You're the person establishing the look.
Yes. Theoretically.
Yeah.
So there are probably, you know, there are several artists that will be doing some development work on any one project. And it's just sort of the combination of elements from this person and elements from that painting over there from somebody else and another person. And you just sort of like the director will be picking out parts of different people's work. And that, you know, sort of kind of helps to focus down on what the actual style will end up being.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you about color scripts. And this is something that I'd like you to explain to the listeners what it is. And do you do it on every picture? Go ahead.
Okay. So a color script is the visual equivalent of a written script. It is a visual interpretation of the script. So a color script will take you paint up little frames, little thumbnails of what the film would look like the final frame of film would look like. And you do a whole bunch of these for each sequence. And sometimes you even break them down further if there's some kind of, you know, really important action within a sequence, then you can always break it down further, like a submenu to a submenu to a submenu. But it's a way of looking at a film without actually making the film. So it's a way of seeing what these final frames look like. And you can make all of your mistakes at this point. You can make all of the visual mistakes you want to, and they are so easy to fix at that point because you make those adjustments, and that saves you time and money down the line by, you know, you don't have to redo animation, you don't have to redo you know, whole sequences of films, which we have done before. Yeah. Shh, don't tell anybody what has happened.
But it is, yeah. I was gonna say. I mean, it's a essentially a using color. When I look at a color script for a film, I can see the palette changing. You know, yes. From say cool to warm, mm-hmm. Or you know, you can see the palette go to a very hot point where the climax of the movie is happening.
Yeah, oftentimes. And that is the beauty of these little color scripts, is because you can actually see how much time is spent at that climax. You know, are we like dragging this whole thing out too long? Are we not spending enough time on it? Is it the right hot pink? Is hot pink the right color for this moment in the film? Maybe we should change it to an icy blue. So that's what the color script is really, really good for. It shows you the entire film without having to actually do the animation and go through where, you know, spend $40 million on something that you're just going to redo.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, it's also, the color scripts are always, to my eye, more energetic and more fascinating than, you know, the finished product. What you see on screen has been pasteurized and homogenized and evened out. You know, it's an artifact of the process. But the color script can be much more charged. You know, it's just more, it's more energized, I would say. Funner to look at, to me.
I think they're beautiful pieces of art, actually.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, and now, John, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think down in Orlando at the Art of Animation Resort, I think there's an example of a color script on a wall. Down in, I think, the main lobby of that resort.
Yep. You're right.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah.
Do you know which one it is? Do you remember?
Gosh, I cannot remember what it was from, but the Art of Animation Resort uses, it's like four hotels with one like main building, if you will. And I think they use The Lion King, Finding Nemo, Cars, and
Mermaid.
Little Mermaid. Thank you. And so I don't recall what that color script, if it was from a Pixar film or a Disney animation film. I'm not sure.
I could probably eliminate Mermaid.
Because there was no color script?
There was not a color script.
Yeah.
There was not a mature color script the way we visualize them.
We view them now. And by the way, if the listeners want to see what a color script looks like, I think you can Google it. And there's probably some examples.
I've got a few on my site too.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can just Google color script and
It may be a color script from Finding Nemo. I'm not sure. I'm not really 100% sure.
So they actually have color scripts, I think, of, oh gosh, I want to say it is Finding Nemo, just looking at the different photos of the lobby.
Yeah, so it is probably Finding Nemo. Okay.
I think it's Finding Nemo, but it's pretty cool how you can see, as Christy, you were talking about, the different colors as it pertains to the different scenes of a particular film, you know. So it's really cool. Yeah, you can see if it's warm or if it's cold.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Somebody should do a book on color scripts and just literally.
Yeah, Dave.
I know, really. Put a book together. I'm giving away ideas here. Put a book together on just the color scripts from all the Disney animated films that had color scripts. I think that would be kind of interesting. You know, I mean, really just a visually fun book to go through. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what are some of your favorite backgrounds just as a fan of being, you know, of well-painted backgrounds?
Any background out of Sleeping Beauty. Mm-hmm. That is for me, that is the pinnacle of design and color. And oh gosh, it is just, to me, it's the most beautiful film. The most beautiful. And of course that was Ivan Earle. Yeah. And there's one scene where they're in the glade. They've just met Aurora and the prince have met. And of course they instantly fall in love and they start dancing. And then she says, "What's your name?" Or he says, "What's your name?" One of them says, "Hey, by the way, what's your name?" But when they start dancing, it's a long shot. It's an establishing shot and they're dancing along and they're reflected in the stream beneath them. Uh-huh. Oh my gosh.
It's gorgeous.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's just the most beautiful 6 seconds of film I think ever made. Mm. It is just absolutely luscious. And I would say Sleeping Beauty. I know, you know, the Bambi backgrounds, of course, were absolutely incredible too, as was Pinocchio.
Oh yeah. I mean, the Pinocchio, you know, Geppetto's workbench.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just absolutely stunning. Claude Coates at his height, you know, as a background painter.
I mean,
unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. But still, I say Sleeping Beauty wins out.
I think that's great. I mean, everybody has their own favorites, and that's what's so wonderful about it all. Mm-hmm. You know. And what are you doing now, aside from working with me occasionally? I mean, whatever you can talk about, I think is great.
So a couple of months ago, I finally. Well, for the last several years, I've been working on a project. I don't know if I can talk about it. I think I can.
Well, don't. If you can't, I mean, you know.
So I've been working on an unnamed project for several years now.
Oh, that's awesome.
An unnamable project for several years. And just a couple of months ago, we broke for, I'm not sure how long I have left, but I have at least another couple of months before it picks up again. Yeah. And so in that time, I'm just going back to what I've been picking up in the last, you know, on my own in the last couple of years, which is just my own landscape paintings. And I also have gotten well into iconography, which is, you know, just like, you know, the saint with a halo. And I knew, like, for a long time, I always wanted to learn how to paint with egg tempera, which is an ancient medium. And I was just, I noticed this little blurb in the church bulletin one day about this guy who was teaching people how to paint icons with egg tempera. And so I went to the meeting and I was just like totally hooked. That was about 3 years ago. So I've been doing iconography and landscape paintings in my spare time.
Awesome.
And in the end, you know, when I'm not chained to my computer doing development work.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Wow. Yeah. I mean, you know, I have to tell you, though, it really is amazing in this business that, you know, there was this period of time in the 1990s where all of these artists came together to work on some incredible animated films as part of this renaissance of Disney animation. Yeah. And then everybody's kind of gone to the wind, so to speak, to go off and do all these other incredible projects and work on all these and the difference between when we got into the studio into the business and now is that there's so many more studios. There's DreamWorks, there's Sony ImageWorks, there's
Warner Brothers, Universal,
yeah, you know,
Netflix. I mean,
it just goes on and on, you know. And that's what's so amazing about the business today is that there's so many places that you can go to get work at if you want to, as opposed to what it was like 30 or 40 years ago when there was, you know, you could count on one hand the studios that were, you know, you might have a chance of being able to get a job at, you know. So
We were very we were lucky. I just feel like I was just
right place, right place, right time.
Right place, right time. Thank God.
Well, this has been fabulous, Christy, chatting with you. I'm so thrilled that you came on to the show. And by the way, I would say that it was just coincidental. Christy and I were talking before we started started recording the show. It was very coincidental that it happens to be the first weekend and our first Skull Rock podcast of the Women's History Month, and so it's great having a woman on for the first first show of Women's History Month. But it was really just kind of a coincidence, you know. I mean, I always view you know, my colleagues as artists first.
Yes, that's one thing that I really love about this business too. Yeah. Is that we're all artists first.
Yeah. And it's all about, it's not just being an artist. It's about your talent, and everybody's at different levels and proficient in different areas, and everybody helps one another out. And I think that's wonderful. So anyway, I just wanted to say it was just thrilling to have you on our show and hear more about how you got into the business and what you've been doing in the business.
Can I say just one more thing?
Yes, absolutely.
One more
thing. Always. Always.
Because for anybody listening, for listeners, pay attention to backgrounds, because they don't just happen. That's one thing that I wouldn't say it's my life's mission is to make people aware of backgrounds, but backgrounds are only backgrounds. You know, that's my first boss, Alcamira, used to say that it's just a background. And he's absolutely 100% correct. But if that background isn't there, you notice something's missing. Like if you're just looking, you and I, Dave, we have seen animation just without a background. You just saw black or something. And it's not a finished piece of work. It has to have the background. So when you're watching Little Mermaid or you're watching whatever you're watching, you know, any of them, Cinderella, any animated film, especially from the pre-digital era when backgrounds were actually painted, you know, there is no such thing as a background painting department now, got eliminated. But when you're watching a film, just pay attention to the backgrounds and know that somebody actually painted that thing with paint and a brush and water, and they mixed those colors and they matched colors to other backgrounds around it, and they put the light source in, and they focused on where the characters were going to be, and they put some time and effort into that thing, just so that you, the viewer, could absorb it sort of in a subconscious manner and just kind of process it. And that's the environment that the character is in. And that background painter did that for you.
Yeah.
And that's something that people do not, they aren't supposed to meant to notice these backgrounds. They're not supposed to, but background has to be there. And I just am just sort of like a little advocate for backgrounds in general. So
I think that's great, because the one thing I would say to follow up on that is that there are all these different components that go into making an animated film. Absolutely. And the amount of times people watch some of these films, because we all know that there are, the audience out there, people love certain films. You know, they may love The Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast, and they watch it on a regular basis. And some of them have seen it hundreds of times or 50 times or whatever it is. And I would say that if you're one of those people, the next time you sit down and watch your favorite animated film, watch it through a different lens. look at the backgrounds, listen to the musical score, look at the special effects. You know, all of these things, all these components come together to make these magnificent movies that most people sort of look at in general without ever really thinking about the background or other parts of what they're seeing. They're looking at Ariel or Flounder, or they're looking at Belle and the Beast,
which is absolutely what you're supposed to be doing. And
absolutely,
yeah, and so it works in that way. But the whole final frame, including the music and the dialogue, it is not complete without, if one of those things drops out,
you know.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know. So I think those are great parting words. I think people should examine these films more deeply and pay more attention to certain aspects when they watch a film.
Yeah.
Well, I think the backgrounds are amazing because first of all, you're involved in Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. My wife and I's, you know, respective favorite films, Aladdin for me, Beauty and the Beast for her. And the backgrounds are absolutely amazing. And
so there is one background in Beauty and the Beast that I kind of cheated on.
Okay.
which your wife may be aware of if she has watched it, you know, a bazillion times.
She has, yeah.
But there is a point where Maurice, Belle's father, is lost. He gets lost. And he's on his horse, and he sees a signpost. And on the signpost, there are some, you know, names. They happen to be Valencia, Newhall, and Saugus, and Anaheim. Because that day, I was tired. I couldn't think. I live in Valencia.
You were mis.
I can put that there.
You were mischievous. You know,
and
when you look at these animated films, there's all kinds of little things that people have thrown in. The artists have put in their names.
Yes.
I think in Hunchback, they're in one of the big establishing shots of Paris. There's a satellite dish and a motorhome.
Care of Mike Humphreys.
Yeah, yes. You can see. I think in that establishing shot, you can see Belle moving through the crowd. From Beauty and the Beast, you know, there's all these funny little Easter eggs as they call them now. That are harmless and just sort of fun. And if you know where to look for them, you'll find them.
So that was the perfect segue to what I was going to ask, because, you know, Christy's here and being a great background artist, so prolific, I wanted to ask, where are some other Easter eggs maybe that you and the team may have kind of put in there, other than that Beauty and the Beast one? Because we knew about that, and that's awesome. But I've got to know. Inquiring minds got to know.
You know what, Aljon? I wish I could tell you, but the thing is, people don't, like, we didn't really disclose where we were putting these things. Uh-huh. And I know of others which will remain unspoken. For background painters, if it was going to be something within the frame, then you had to be very, very, very careful about what you were doing. Yeah. Because at some point, you know, it was right after Mermaid, or maybe during Rescuers, that that it turned out that people were going to be watching these things on DVD, and they could just, like, freeze a frame. And up until then, that was not an issue. But
yeah,
if it was outside of frame, so there were plenty of guys putting Yogi Bear outside of, over there on the other side of the tree, that would never, we'll never see that, that kind of stuff. But as far as those go, Alton, there really aren't any that would be, like I just told you about the one that was the most blatant one that I've ever put in. And I didn't even think it would show on screen. And when we saw it in dailies, people giggled, and I called the art because they saw it. And I didn't think it was going to be visible or noticeable, but I called the art director and I said, you know, people saw this, so you might want to change it. And they never changed it.
I love it.
Yeah, it's those things. If it showed on screen, then you had to be very, very, very discreet about what you were putting in, and you just kind of kept it to yourself. Like, there was one guy who would put like the initials of his kids on license plates and things like that.
Yeah. And you know something, most of the, I would say 99.9% of these things are harmless and fun little things if you can find them. You know, the one or two sort of questionable ones that have come out over the years were unfortunate and shouldn't have been in there. But I think for the most part, it's clean, wholesome fun, as I like to call it.
Yes,
I think some of the coolest you know, backgrounds, like I said, you know, are in Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast. And thank you so much for that, and thank you so much for also supplying some great art from you know, growing up on Saturday morning cartoons, you know,
because that's right.
I think the Smurfs and the Flintstone Kids were just you know, pretty much on everybody's mind. You know, if you grew up in that era like myself, we definitely love that stuff.
So. It was appointment TV on Saturday mornings.
Absolutely.
Well, Christy, hey, listen, thank you so much for being on the show. I look forward to us being able to crack another wonderful bottle of wine at a local restaurant.
Absolutely.
Hopefully in the not too distant future, maybe this summer. Maybe we'll actually have a summer.
Yeah, that would be great. Let's just plan on that and make it. We'll just make it happen.
We will. Thank you again. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me. It was a real pleasure. Enjoyed it. And it was nice to meet you, Aljon.
Thank you so much.
Skull Rock Podcast, your weekly dose of pixie dust.
What an awesome, awesome interview, Dave. I mean, Christy, she's a delight. What a delight.
Yeah, you know, she's really fantastic. She's been just a tremendous friend and colleague in the animation business, and I've always adored working with her. It's just you know, it was terrific. I mean, it was so great to have her on the show. I just love being able to visit with all these people. Aljon, while we're cooped up, you know, self-isolating in our homes, this has been just such a tremendous amount of fun.
And absolutely. And you know what I absolutely love about this show, and the fact that we visit every single week with not only your friends, but I get to also take part, is that it just breaks the doldrums that we're all experiencing with these shutdowns. You know, this podcast came at a great time, not only for me, but I'm sure for many of our listeners, because it just gives us an opportunity to just break away, throw on the headphones, you know, kick this through the Bluetooth speakers, and just listen to some great conversation, coffee talk, if you will, Dave. You know, I'm a big fan of coffee talk. I love coffee talk.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. And I hope it continues. I mean, even though people are going to be out and about and getting out of their houses once they're vaccinated, I hope people will continue to tune in, because we've got an incredible slate of guests coming up. And I do want to mention, just for next week, we have Bob Gurr, the Imagineer, Bob Gurr himself, who's, by the way, going to be 90 this year.
Unbelievable.
And is just incredibly spry. You wouldn't know the guy's 90. You know, he mountain bikes and he goes out and about. He's always doing something.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to having him on the show next week.
And Bob is the best. And I've had an opportunity, what an honor, to talk and chat with him several times through my years of covering Disney events and just hanging, doing special events at Walt Disney World. And Bob is just the best. So I can't wait.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. So that was a great tease, Dave. And once again, I encourage everyone, you know, if you're a fan of the show, you just stumbled upon us, please subscribe to our show on your favorite podcast platform, and like and share and subscribe to our feed there on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. We do appreciate that. And visit skullrockpodcast.com. and email Dave or myself. We love getting emails, and we encourage you to just reach out or just DM us on any of those social media platforms, and we'd love to hear from you. Dave, you know, anything else you'd like to add before we kind of sign off for this week?
Yeah, you know, I just want to let people know that there is there are some author signed copies of 3D Disneyland like you've never seen it before. And those are available at theoldmillpress.com. theoldmillpress.com. You can order a author signed copy. Just wanted to give it a little shameless plug since they just got a whole bunch of new inventory in on the book. And that's about it. I am excited about the fact that it's staying lighter out longer. We're going to go to daylight's savings time in a week or two, I think it is. Mm-hmm. And everything's looking up. People are getting vaccinated. It's the world is going to open up like a flower and bloom.
I can't wait. And I'd also like to give a little shout out to our friends at Disney Dorks who allow us to kind of post when new stuff comes along. What a great community for Disney fans over at Disney Dorks. And also Sorcerer Radio. They're doing a site redesign, and they're including us in some of their great podcast promotions, which is great. So thank you so much. And Sorcerer Radio, happy birthday. I've been a member of Sorcerer Radio as a DJ with the Disney List, and before then the WDW Tiki Room. Now they've been around, Dave, for 20 years.
Wow.
Actually, yeah, since 19.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, since yeah,
we're newbie. I feel like a newbie to this. You know, we're all newbies.
It's
or
great.
I am anyway.
Well, you know, Source Radio has been the home of so many great podcasts and podcast people and pioneers in Disney podcasts, from, you know, the Lou Mangiello's of the world to to so many people. But that's just one notable person that had been part of the early days of Source Radio, and Lou and I are still buddies. So it's great that the Sorcerer Radio fans are doing great and promoting our show as well. So thank you so much to the Sorcerer Radio community for 20 years.
And, you know, I have to say, Al John, let's just take it a step further, because there's so many great podcasts out there. The Bancroft Brothers
have a
podcast. There's laughingplace.com. There's the Tiara Show with Tammy Tuckey. Yep. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of really great people that are doing some really good shows. So certainly seek those folks out.
Yep, absolutely. And I'm sure we're going to be going on those podcasts again to promote this show, because I know we've been on Lynn Barron's show at Sweep Spot and so many others. But all of those people, great people. So if you love this podcast, not only subscribe and give us those reviews, but also subscribe to our friends as well. They'd love to see you as we build this podcast community. So
that's it.
All right. Well, have a great week, everybody. Dave, thank you so much. And we'll see you next
week.
Thank
you, Al John.
Right on.
Have a great week yourself. And I will see you next week.
Take care, everyone.
I'm Kristen Hetzel, vacation planner, world traveler, Disney foodie, and theme park fan.
I'm Al John Goh. I'm the husband who's also Disney, Star Wars, and Marvel Comics fan. And together, we host the Disney List podcast.
Every week, you'll hear us list our favorite things about Disney theme parks, films, shows, travel, Marvel, and Star Wars in a top 10 list, rankings, and more.
That's an impressive list. Subscribe to the Disney List podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. You can even stream us on Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com and check out our live shows on Facebook. The Disney List podcast. Visit thedisneylist.com.